This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we are airing a panel on the impeachment process that compares the two previous impeachment proceedings of President Johnson and President Clinton with the ongoing impeachment of President Donald Trump. In December, the House of Representatives impeached President Trump for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Articles of impeachment were then handed over to the Senate, where, over the last week, House managers made their case over the course of 3 days. The president's defense team was then given the same time to argue on behalf of the president. After these opening statements, senators will be given 2 days to ask questions before a vote on the last day of January whether to include new documents and witness testimonies. To put this impeachment process into historical, political, and legal perspective are Robert Adler, distinguished professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law, Jim Curry, associate professor of political science at the U, and Jeremy Pope, associate professor of the BYU Political Science Department. Moderating the panel is Jason Perry, director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics. This forum was recorded on January 21st, 2020, the day the Senate impeachment trial began. Here's your moderator, Jason Perry.
All right, welcome everyone. Thank you, Viba, for the introductions right there. Can you believe you are at a forum on impeachment on the day impeachment trials are starting in the United States Senate? I'm not sure how we planned something like that.
Great prescience.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'll tell you, this panel today, you're going to love. Even if you paid more tuition, you could not get better panelists. Quite the bargain for you all today here. We're just so glad you're able to be here with us. Such an important topic. It's not something that has happened very many times in U.S. history. A lot of the rules are being written as we're going, and we have a group of experts today who are going to be able to talk all about it from the founding fathers to what's happening this very day. Be ready. At the end of this last 15 or 20 minutes, we're going to take some questions from all of you. We have lots of great visitors with us. We try to prioritize students, but we want to hear from everyone, all right? So be ready, because you don't have a panel like this very often. So I'm going to start here. I can't really see you all very well, but let's begin with this, all right? We may as well go to the beginning. All right, Jeremy, let's start with you. What did the founding fathers think an impeachment proceeding was supposed to be like? Why did they build this into the Constitution?
First of all, let me say thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I hesitate to say it's a pleasure to talk about impeachment, but I do look forward to doing it. If I could back up one step from your question and just say, one of the things that the Constitutional Convention debated most extensively, especially after they had solved questions of representation, or at least solved it to their satisfaction, was how independent will the executive be? And the way this worked out was that the coalitions had really shifted. You had kind of a different group of people that was arguing on each side. Some people wanted the president to be very independent. Some people wanted the president to essentially be the tool of Congress. The initial plan that they looked at was that the Congress would elect the president and they would decide on the president, which would mean that you'd have very little need for an impeachment process because the president would be beholden to Congress in various ways. You might still have some kind of procedure, but it wouldn't have been nearly as important. So you get to the end of the convention and they've settled eventually on the cumbersome electoral college process, and they've decided to create a very independent executive over the objections of not a small number of delegates. And at this point, it becomes clear, well, what if the president gets out of line? Because the design of the Constitution is that Congress is the first branch. So what will happen? And they debate, well, we'll have to remove the president. And there is, if you go into the notes, actually probably less discussion than you would imagine about this. They don't spend that much time on it. They just accept the notion that Congress will essentially have to remove a president at some point, or at least the threat of this needs to be there. So they debate how this would go. They debate the wording. Will it be for maladministration? Will it be for high crimes and misdemeanors? I'll say now, and the panelists here may or may not agree with this, I'm not sure the wording is that important. What I think is important is the process that they came up with. They set a very simple threshold. A simple majority in the House will be able to impeach a president and put that black mark on his or someday her record. But a supermajority, an undefined supermajority because it comes from the Senate, will have to be put in place to actually remove a president. There is a key vote in the Constitutional Convention where they debate, should it be a three-quarters majority of the Senate or a two-thirds? Can you imagine if it was a three-quarters majority? Then it would truly be hopeless and impossible to get rid of a president. They end up settling on a two-thirds. But the point of what they did was essentially create a safety valve for a president that was seen as illegitimate by the Congress. But they set a pretty high threshold to get there. To actually remove a president, you needed 2/3 of the Senate. That threshold isn't exactly, you can't say it's 67% of the country or the popular vote because it's senators, but it is a pretty high threshold that they set. And I don't know that they all really necessarily agreed on that, because a lot of them wanted a president who was more, like I said, the tool of Congress. We didn't get that, though. We got a pretty independent president. That's what they decided on.
Mm-hmm. Robert. Jim.
So let me add to the separation of powers story here. There was this issue about the relationship between the executive branch and the legislative, but there was also a concern about the power of the judicial branch. So one of the reasons that the founders established an impeachment process in the legislature was that they thought that the judges would be wary of prosecuting high public officials. These were powerful officials, and many of the judges had been appointed by the executive branch. So they thought it was important to have a check on the executive, to have someone else who could check their power. It was also a matter of remedy. So if an executive official was prosecuted in court, the court did not have the power, the jurisdiction to remove them from office. And we actually have a recent example, the impeachment of Judge William Nixon, what people refer to as the other Nixon impeachment, in which a federal judge, Judge Nixon, was convicted in court of essentially taking a bribe, but refused to step down from the federal bench. So you needed impeachment to remove this convicted federal official from public office. And that's what impeachment is all about, is did the official conduct an offense which implicates their ability to serve the public trust, to protect the public welfare?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a ton to add on top of what my esteemed fellow panelists have put here, but just to say more about how impeachment was added is just adding to the broad separation of powers and checks and balances setup that the Constitution was designed around. As Madison had written about it, first you have to create a government that can control the people, then you have to make it so that it can control itself. And part of that was giving each branch the means of being sufficiently independent and having its own source of power, and then subsequently giving each branch the ability to check the other. And for Congress, one of their big checks on both the executive and the judiciary is the ability to remove those people from office if they are sufficiently out of line. Now, it is interesting that there isn't a whole lot given to the other two branches to check the Congress, but that's part of why they did a lot to the Congress to make it check itself by splitting it in half and making it a really difficult thing to work through in the first place. But this is part and parcel of it. If you had no ability for the legislature to check the other branches, we wouldn't have as robust a system of checks and balances as we do, and impeachment's a big part of that.
Amusing part of the Constitutional Convention? Ben Franklin's argument in favor of impeachment was that it's good for the executive magistrate, the president, because the alternative historically was assassination. He argued this in the convention, and you never know with Franklin whether he was being serious or facetious or both. But if you think about it, our system of government is designed to have peaceful transitions to avoid that sort of thing. So it had something to recommend it.
The president should say thank you for this.
Then. Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
I was wondering where that was going. Let's pick up a couple of themes from all of this you had, Jim, because I want to hear this part. Not a lot of language is given to what the proceeding is going to look like, but I want to get your read of this, because there is not a lot of check on Congress on this, but right now, even this morning, as they're getting ready to start, what we're watching on the news is everyone says, all we want is a fair trial, all right? That's all we want. Just give us a fair trial, which makes me have to wonder, what is a fair trial, given what we have here? And that starts sounding like law, but is this law or is this about politics?
Impeachment is a political process. And you've probably heard that said by a lot of people over the last several months, but it's true. This is not about sending the president to jail, about convicting the president of a crime. That's something that would have to occur separately anyway. This is a process about whether you remove or do not remove a specific public official from a specific office. And so, obviously, the president's messaging team around impeachment has been, this is not a fair trial, this, where are my rights, where's my representation, where's due process? Well, those things are, to some degree, irrelevant, because it's not a court of law. It's not being convicted of a crime. And so it doesn't have to follow what we typically think about what would happen in a court. However, a lot of those things are still afforded through the impeachment process anyway. Less so in the House, though by precedent, the president is offered the opportunity to be represented while the Judiciary Committee is doing its proceedings and drafting up articles of impeachment, which is something that the president's counsels declined. But in the Senate, you have something that mocks it a bit more. You have the House managers that function as the prosecution. You have the president's defense team, which functions as a defense. Each side has the opportunity to raise evidence, make its case, et cetera, answer questions before the jury, which is the body of the Senate. So it's not a legal process at all, it's really a political process. In some ways, it still mimics one in a lot of ways, though not exactly the same.
Well, what does our lawyer say?
So I would actually respectfully disagree in two respects. Number one, I think it's about both law and politics. The Constitution says the Senate shall have the sole power to try whoever is impeached. The founders knew what a trial was. I think they expected the process to at least resemble a trial, and the previous impeachment trials of presidents have not been exactly like a civil or criminal trial, but they've had witnesses, they've had evidence, they've had arguments. It resembles a trial-type procedure, and I think that's what the founders expected and what the American public expects. Second, the Constitution said convicted on treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. So there needs to be some legal judgment about what occurred. The original text said misapplication or maladministration, and that was rejected because that would suggest that you could convict someone, impeach someone, because you disagreed on policy or because you thought they were ineffective in their role. They rejected that. There needs to be some sort of behavior that rises to impeachment. My second ground for disagreement is what we mean by the word political. We've got this cynical view of political as meaning, oh, that's just politics and partisan political haggling. What the founders meant was to ask, is this offense of sufficient moment that it impairs the ability of this official to fulfill their public functions? How does it affect the body politic? How does it affect our political system, our system of governance? That's what I think the founders meant by this being a political as well as a legal process.
Let him respond really quick.
I mean, yes, I generally agree with that. But first, to give my rebuttal, that language of treason, bribery, high crimes, and misdemeanors is vague, and maybe intentionally so, such that the political officials of the time could decide, does this thing rise to that occasion? Which, for all intents and purposes, the House of Representatives can decide that anything does if 218 of them agree. Then the president is impeached. And then that sets a precedent for what isn't an impeachable offense. The Senate now gets to decide if they want to convict the president, if that's sufficient grounds in their opinion too, for two-thirds of them. But by political, all I mean is that this is about whether someone or not gets to hold a public office, and not about whether or not they go to jail or are convicted of a crime.
And in the end, that is a matter of who has the votes.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Hey. Something I like to tell people that ask me about this question of, like, what is the standard for impeachment is there's a five-word phrase. The process is the standard. The process is the thing that they created. They have the language about treason and bribery and so on and so forth, but there are two clauses of the Constitution that you should think about with respect to impeachment. One is obvious. It's the impeachment clause that sets the thresholds. The other one is less obvious. It's the rule that both chambers are independently the judge of their own rules. Because they didn't lay out any other rules for impeachment, they just simply said the Senate tries it, the Senate can decide what its rules are. And I am quite sure that you're going to see some controversy over what the rules will be in the coming days. And who will decide it? A majority of the Senate. The one interesting thing, and I don't mean to preempt your questionability, I would love to hear the panel talk about the one thing that I don't know.
Except he's doing it.
Yeah, I lied. I do that a lot. I would love to know what we think about the process of who will decide ties, because there is a precedent that the Chief Justice maybe gets appealed to. I wonder if Republicans will try to somehow throw Mike Pence in there and get him to vote on this. I hope they don't.
Pence can't.
So Pence cannot. But let's talk about that. We have some constitutional experts here because we do know what happens with the House, right? The Senate. There's not a constitutional statement about what happens in terms of a tie on this occasion.
No. So in normal Senate process, the vice president is the presiding officer in the Senate. In the case of impeachment of a president, the Constitution specifically provides that the Chief Justice shall preside. What that means is, I think, what is open for debate. But it's very clear that the reason the founders did that is that if a president is impeached, who becomes president? The vice president, which means that there's a wee bit of a conflict of interest for the vice president to preside. And so I don't think the vice president has any role whatsoever. The key question, I think, is the role of the Chief Justice and what shall preside means. And another take on why the Chief Justice presides in presidential impeachment, it is so inherently political that you want a presumptive person of high stature, high legal training, to make some of these judgments. And I actually think the American public would feel much better about this if the Chief Justice first decided whether John Bolton has relevant testimony to provide and whether he's an admissible witness. And then the Senate can decide to overrule him or not, but they'll do so in the face of a legal judgment by the Chief Justice of the United States.
So Jeremy, talk about that for just a moment too, because of course the Chief Justice can make a ruling which can be immediately overturned by a simple majority of the Senate.
He can certainly offer his assessment of things. Whether or not I would call it a ruling is actually kind of open to question in my mind, because again, the Senate decides its own rules. Will they call it a ruling? How will they think about it? A majority of the Senate will decide what their rules actually look like. That's why that clause is so important, that each house determines its own rules. I very much agree with what you just said, Bob, about how that's what I would like to see happen. I really have very little confidence that that is exactly what will happen. And I think we're going to see some controversies over the rules. I think they will attempt that, even though normatively I like your assessment of where the Chief Justice is. It's not entirely clear to me that they will treat it that way.
Impeachment of a president is such a unique circumstance because it's the only one, because it so rarely happened, right? This is only the third Senate trial of a president. And so we don't have a ton of precedent to build off of. And the Andrew Johnson case was so odd anyway.
As opposed to the second one?
It makes the Clinton one seem very institutionalized, at least in my opinion. But it's the only process that occurs that I know about where that involves making a formal decision that involves members of the House and members of the Senate and members of the judiciary all in one room. And so there's not a lot of guidance on, the Chief Justice is the presiding officer. Does he get all the rights of every other presiding officer, i.e. the vice president or the pro tem, or not, because he's not a member of the body? There's so many things that are unclear because they're untested. And the Senate parliamentarian would have to, and the Senate historian would have to consult and try to offer some sort of guidance, which is quite, they don't know either.
I would note that Chief Justice Samuel Chase did vote twice to resolve ties in the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. That was very controversial, and it irked the senators, and they urged him not to do so again, and he backed off. So there is some precedent, but not clear what it means.
Two directions, because he did it, and then they told him not to, and he backed off. So what's the precedent?
Exactly.
That's what makes that so dicey. It's unclear. they clearly don't want the Chief Justice to usurp their power, but it would be interesting if a Chief Justice was bold and tried.
That was Jeremy Pope, Associate Professor of the BYU Political Science Department. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today we are airing a panel taking a legal and political perspective on the process of impeachment, then and now. Here again is moderator Jason Perry, director of the Hinckley Institute.
So talk about that process for a minute. Maybe some circumstances at the time, even as both sides were talking about this impeachment proceedings. Since Lin-Manuel, I've never heard so much, you know, founding fathers quoted, right, about this. Have circumstances changed a little bit? Why did they not put more process into this proceeding? Was there something there that they weren't worried about that exists today?
Can I take issue with the question just a tiny bit and say, I think they did put a lot of process in it. They made it really, really hard to impeach and remove a president. They didn't really need to go any further than that. They wanted to make this process difficult, and they did. They required each chamber to do it. And in their minds, the two chambers were going to have a very different character from one another, much more different than we see the two chambers as being today, especially because the Senate at the time was selected entirely by state legislatures. So there is this process. It's just that the mechanics of the trial are not laid out in any meaningful way, which means they have to go look up what happened to Andrew Johnson and what were the rules for Bill Clinton. But on the big picture thing, they got what they wanted. They made the president very independent. They made it super hard to get rid of him.
Well, let's put this. Let me follow up with this quote. You've heard it before because some people like it, some don't. From Gerald Ford, even about what an impeachable offense is. Because I know you say, you know, they made it possible, but even this, Gerald Ford said, an impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives considered it to be at any given moment in history.
That's correct.
As a matter of practice, that's correct.
So is that's what you're talking. So we have that.
They are limited only by their own prudence and judgment.
Okay,
that's
so make your argument there for why leave that one so open. So at any given period of time, whatever it means to create an offense is whatever you all in power say it is.
This is one possible explanation. And there's probably a number of possible explanations for why specifically impeachment was laid out as it was. But it was hard enough for the framers to come to an agreement about a very loose, vague document that would structure the government. It took them months. They spent oftentimes weeks debating something like exactly how will we select the president. So getting into the fine-grained details of what will the process of this or that be, it just never would have happened. Where like things had to, at some level, be left vague in order for things, when you're coalition building and you need a supermajority of states to go along, first in the convention and then subsequently in ratifying it, you've got to keep things on like at a certain level of detail to build that coalition. And so even if they had wanted to, which that's a whole nother debate, whether or not they would have wanted to define what is and what is not impeachment, which maybe they didn't, they never would have been able to come to an agreement around that kind of detail.
I also think it was in part a matter of trusting the institutions. To the extent that there was an extensive debate in the convention about impeachment, you're right, it wasn't about whether to have impeachment, but it was who should have that authority. And there were various proposals to have a whole group of state judges try the impeachment of federal officials. And they thought, well, that would make the federal government too beholden to the states. And then there was the idea that the U.S. Supreme Court should try impeachments. And the idea was that, well, that's too small a body of individuals to make this political sort of judgment. And the Supreme Court justices were appointed by the executive, so they were beholden to the executive. So eventually, they decided that, just like was true in England, remember, there was a long history of impeachment in England by the House of Commons, trial by the House of Lords, and the founders thought that the institution of Congress could be trusted with this rather grave responsibility on the House to make the initial call on impeachment, But they were only in office for 2 years. They might be too political about making that judgment. And the founders felt that the Senate, you know, in office for 6 years, would be above the political fray. Whatever you think about that now, they had faith in the institution of the Senate to be a fair tribunal. And so they didn't need to specify all the procedures.
Can I just throw out, the Senate now just isn't that much like the Senate of 1790 or even 1850. It's elected directly by the people. A lot of the rules have changed. The Senate just has a different character than it once did. I'm pretty confident that they were correct in lodging it in the Senate. Now, whether our changes to the Senate, whatever other good consequences they have had, have helped us out with impeachment, I am less sure that is true.
Anyone else on this? So, based on your reading and your understanding of history, what differences may exist in this current proceeding than what we have seen historically? We had some process even on President Nixon, even though he resigned before impeachment. What is substantially different in this one than we've had before, if anything?
We're in the age of Twitter and cable news, and our politicians are affected more by the moment than they were previously.
Okay, well, you probably know where I'm going with that. Okay, go ahead.
What I was going to say is, and I've been asked this question a lot, specifically about the House, because if I have any sort of specialty in life, it's House procedures. And the procedures that happened in the House over impeachment were far more similar to how they were for Clinton and Nixon than they were different. Just like there's always slight differences each time. There's been a variety of ways impeachment inquiries have been begun. There's been a variety of specifics about how witnesses would be subpoenaed or how evidence would be brought before the committees or which committees did most of the heavy lifting. But generally, it was in the House, it was roughly the same and ultimately like unusually similar to in terms of timeline to how things went down with the Clinton impeachment.
Okay, so one last thing before we take some audience questions. I'd like to hit this thread that Bob was just talking about. So this is supposed to be about justice, right? It's supposed to be about the rule of law in some way in the Constitution. How much does public opinion weigh into these votes on impeachment, which is supposed to be something so much higher, that's higher level?
Well, I kind of preempted myself by, you know, joking about the Twitter and stuff, but it is supposed to be about justice. It's supposed to be about evidence. And what I find amazing is the idea that you set the rules for an impeachment trial in the moment of a particular trial. Right, we have in courts, we have rules of procedure, we've got rules of evidence that are adopted irrespective of who the prosecutor is, who the defendant is. It's supposed to be neutral, right? This is John Rawls's concept of justice, that you set the rules independent of the particular circumstance. Here, what's going on is you've got Mitch McConnell, you know, fighting with Chuck Schumer about the rules for a particular trial of a particular defendant, and therefore it's affected by the politics of it. And I just think that's wrong.
Whether or not that's normatively ideal, that's how it's done, I think that is precisely how our political system was set up to function. The founders did not set up a system where they hoped everyone would behave well or hold to some higher order. Madison wrote about this specifically, if men were angels, no government would be necessary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And his answer to his solution to that problem was ambition must be made to counteract ambition, which basically means you should expect that every actor, every institution, every party, every group is going to use whatever procedural hardball they have within what is considered the norms of their time to try to get what they want. And what safeguards us is that so will everyone else. And so in this case, yes, the Democrats were going to take what procedural hardball advantage they could in pushing for impeachment, and now so will Mitch McConnell. And that's what saves us from tyranny.
I guess I'm the cynical weasel of the group here, but I'm not 100% sure this is about justice, because if it was purely about justice, then I think you would have to engage in the kind of Rawlsian thing that was just laid out. And for whatever, for good or ill, maybe both, we don't have that kind of arrangement here. And the other thing I would add about the justice point Trump's not in any danger of anything other than losing his office. He doesn't even really seem to be in danger of that. The only thing he's in danger of is losing his office. Justice, to me, it should be more about life, liberty, those kinds of things. The only question that is in front of the country is whether or not Trump should continue to be president. And that is an inherently political decision that I think is frankly probably a little less about justice, though maybe it's sad that that's true.
Interesting. So, since you're an expert on kind of the political polarization, kind of people getting involved as well, I just kind of curious about how this plays long term, because this is the first time we've had a president impeached in the first term of office. It's in theory we're going to have
Johnson was in his first term, but yeah,
running for election. Okay.
Second,
how about yeah. that? You're right. That was the wrong qualification. Running for office, having been impeached.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me speak to the audience here. I don't know about the audience on the radio. They may be different. They're probably similar, but. Everyone who's here today, unless the only reason you came was because you heard there would be pizza, you're very different than the public at large. Probably at least half of the public, if not more, doesn't care very much about this particular matter. I can point to some polling data that would suggest that. The people that are engaged are very engaged, and I applaud you. I'm glad you're good citizens who care about this kind of thing. In some ways, it might be good if we had more people that cared about this sort of thing. But one of the first facts when you try to explain polarization to people is polarization has to do with the ends of the political spectrum, and there is a broad group of people in the middle who don't care very much about what's going on. And to get to that supermajority threshold I mentioned earlier, it would be good if Democrats could somehow convince the public that there was a crime here, that that the president should be removed. These are the threshold things that are in front of them. If they could do that, then they will have much more success in the trial. I am somewhat skeptical that that is going to happen. Maybe I should just appeal to what Bob said a minute ago about the age of Twitter and all of the sort of changes in our public opinion and political processes.
That was Jeremy Pope, associate professor of the BYU Political Science Department. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel takes questions from the audience of faculty and students. Once more, here's panel moderator and director of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, Jason Perry.
All right, let's hear it. Viva, can you get a microphone? Who's got a question? We have one already. Do you mind if we borrow this one? Thank you, Jeremy.
Hi, my name is Christine. I have been thinking about impeachment, and I've wondered with President Trump being in his first term of office, I know there really isn't much precedent for someone getting reelected after being impeached or thrown out of office. But I was wondering, legally, is he allowed to be reelected? That's probably the wrong word.
Yes. Only if he'd been convicted would he be, I understand, be barred typically from running again. And there is a case of a federal judge who was impeached and removed, and then he's currently a member of the House of Representatives. he later ran for the House, and he's still there. So nothing about it would preclude that in any legal sense whatsoever.
Technically, there are two judgments in impeachment. One is, should the convicted person, if convicted, be removed from office? The second is, should they be precluded from having future office? But the first is a two-thirds majority vote. The second is a majority vote. So it's unlikely that you would remove from office and not get the votes to preclude from future office.
You want to add anything?
I think the second Trump impeachment could be great.
Wow.
Term two.
Just foreshadowing in some way.
Are you going to schedule another forum based on that?
I bet we have a forum on that very day. All right.
4 years from the day. Put it in your calendar.
Okay, that's a good one. Okay, other questions? Who else has one? Yeah, please. We'll hear and then hear, okay?
So I was just thinking about how there's already public perception changing on the Supreme Court. Do you think the involvement of the Chief Justice in a very political process will contribute to that at all?
So was I'm not a lawyer. I feel like I should defer to the lawyer, but I will say that I really think Chief Justice John Roberts is going to be under a microscope here, and his conduct will help define what the public thinks about him. I don't have strong opinions about how that's going to go. Is he bold? Is he timid? How do people react to that? He's got a tough job. I feel a little bit for the man that he has to run this circus. And with the fact that 51 senators can just overrule whatever he says, no matter how logical and reasonable what he says actually is. He's got a tough job. I would not want to be John Roberts.
Anytime Supreme Court justices or the court have to make a decision that seems far more inherently political, that's problematic for the court's desire to seem above and distant from everyday politics. Though, you know, this is something that's been going on throughout American history. We tend to have this sense that it's only lately that the court has been politicized. Well, you know, people were saying the court was dead in the 1850s when it made some controversial decisions regarding slavery. Well, it's not dead. And this tends to ebb and flow, but certainly if he has to make decisions that clearly seem to favor one side or the other, that's not going to help him.
What was the phrase from Justice Rehnquist the last time? My job was to say very little and I did it well. Was something like that?
The one ruling he made was that the senators were not jurors. They were, in fact, judges in the trial. Wow. That's essentially the only role he played, and it was in response to an objection by one of the senators. I forget who it was who made the objection. Uh-huh. But
can I do a follow-up on that to this question, too? Because we even have a division in our own Senate between Mitt Romney and Mike Lee as to whether the role is to be a passive juror or your role is to be involved in some more major way. Any comments about, not on them necessarily, but on those two positions?
So I've made a big deal here today about how the Senate is the judge of its own rules and they can do whatever they want. But there is one interesting thing about this. Like, if I was going to argue against my position here, the existing rules on impeachment say that senators take a new oath when they convene as a body trying impeachment. The oath is a little bit different. It's written out in Senate rules and in legislation. And you could make a case that this oath means that they're convening a kind of, I don't know, Senate subscript 2 or something like that, like a Senate 2 or something. I'm not exactly sure what that would mean. And that they should act like jurors and they should be impartial and so on and so forth. I like that as a normative standard. That sounds good to me. There is almost nothing in anyone's conduct on either side of the aisle that suggests to me that that sort of thing is going to happen. But I will admit, I do like the idea.
Yeah, I mean, then what? Sorry, what? I mean, and what could they do about it if one of them decided, or if more, even more so, if all of them decided not to? I mean, the House could try to impeach them all, but they would get to be the jurors.
Then what would happen?
If I can address all these issues as a matter of law. There is something called the political question doctrine in which the courts have decidedly stayed away from questions that they feel are so inherently political that it would reflect poorly on the judicial branch to decide them. And those are cases that are both inherently political in nature and for which there's no clear legal standard. So there's actually one case in which the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on an impeachment proceeding. And that again was the impeachment of Judge William Nixon, who was convicted based on a trial conducted by a committee of the Senate. And Judge Nixon argued that that violated his constitutional right to a trial before the entire Senate. And the Supreme Court said, the Constitution says the Senate has the sole power to try impeachments, which means they have the sole power to decide the rules, right? They are the judge of their own procedures with three exceptions. The three exceptions are the specific parts of the Constitution about impeachments. Oath or affirmation have to be convicted by a two-thirds majority. And Justice Rehnquist wrote this in the opinion. The third specific requirement is that in the case of presidential impeachments, the Chief Justice shall preside. So I think there's still an open question about what the authority of the Chief Justice is, whether or not Chief Justice Roberts has the inclination, I'll put it that way, to test that, who knows, but it is an open question of law, of constitutional law. And then the question is, who decides on that issue? Does it go to the Supreme Court? Just trying to make it fun.
Wow,
here,
yes.
You know?
Wow, this is gold today, right now, I'm telling you. Okay, got a question right here, and then and Cameron.
The name is Richard. The esteemed Alan Dershowitz is arguing that obstruction of justice, no matter how grossly he is claimed to have obstructed justice, is not a crime, and there is no precedent in the Constitution. And he's trying to make it that there shouldn't even be impeachment based on that. Can you address the whole idea of what he's talking about? Because it seems conflicted to what he said 20 years ago and seems like psychobabble.
Seems like Jeremy's going to take that.
I'm the designated psychobabble member of the panel. One preliminary to your comment, there are a lot of people involved in this impeachment trial where if you scrutinize things they said back in 1998, they have some explaining to do. I think there's a reason that Chuck Schumer has been limited in his comments because he said a number of things in 1998 that are not consistent with the things that he's saying now. So I'm not prepared to get down on Professor Dershowitz for that, but I have to admit, I am baffled by his arguments. I'm sure he's read the Constitution. Jim Curry said it earlier, if a majority of the House thinks that it counts as an impeachable offense, then it does. And if two-thirds of the Senate thinks that that counts as an offense that counts for removal, then again, it does. That's the only set of standards that really, in the end of the day, matter here. And I am just kind of, I don't know if I would have used the word psychobabble, but it's not bad. Congratulations. I don't know what he thinks he's accomplishing with some of the arguments that he's making, because the Constitution is quite clear on these thresholds, extremely clear.
Dershowitz aside, one thing we know about American politics is nothing will shape and reshape the position taking of other politicians in our country quite like which party holds the presidency.
It's also quite clear from contemporaneous records of the Constitution that the founders did not intend impeachable offenses to be limited by the strictures of criminal law. Hamilton said that in the Federalist Number 65. Justice Joseph Story, in his famous commentaries on the Constitution, said this is a common law process where you need to decide what offense is impeachable under the circumstances of the time. So it's very clear that Mr. Dershowitz is simply wrong on this point.
And we got a quote from the Federalist Papers. Nice. Cameron.
Hey, my name is Cameron. So just really quickly, one thing I've really been thinking about is precedent moving forward. Quickly, how do you see the precedent of this administration affecting future administrations, especially as it comes to like partisanship and strong-arming other sections of the government? Yeah.
Who wants to start?
No. Well, there's kind of two pieces to that. So one, you asked about like the attempts by presidents to sort of strong arm and like push the limits of their authority, and you asked about like the sharpness of partisan conflict. First, with the strong arming, like this, I mean, this is what presidents have been doing for a long time, and to some degree, Congress as well. Our system is set up not to hope and pray that everyone will just act well, but to create a system where if somebody tries to overstep their boundaries, the other parts of the government are there to, you know, push back. Nixon certainly went a little haywire in terms of like how aggressive he was going to be in pushing back against the Congress, and so have most presidents. And when Congress is appropriately bothered by this, they have the power to push back, and they do. And impeachment's one example. In terms of partisan conflict, I think partisan conflict has been on a kind of a steady rise now for the last 45 years, and so it's not new to the Trump era. It's just like yet another period, another episode. That's probably not going away anytime soon, a lot because of like the numerous causes that are more like long-term than they are short-term. So I don't think the Trump years have a particularly sharp effect on that, nor do I think the end of the Trump administration, whether that's in 2 weeks or 1 year or 5 years, will really make much difference.
Jeremy.
Here's one thing I'm worried about in terms of precedents. I don't know if this gets to your question, but I would like impeachment just from, you know, Jeremy Pope's opinion to be a little bit more of a principled and less of a partisan kind of activity than I think we're seeing. And I think it's a mistake to think about this impeachment and this trial in a vacuum. I think it's important to think about the other precedents, and in particular, the Clinton precedent. So in 1998, we had what Democrats judged to be an incredibly partisan impeachment. They ran ads against it. They argued that partisan impeachments are bad. Now the script is flipped. Republicans are running essentially the playbook from 1998 and saying this is a partisan impeachment. And they're, to some degree, Republicans are trying to avoid talking about the facts because the facts are not great for Donald Trump in terms of, like, did you take these particular actions? He did. He said he did in various formats. So they need to argue some sort of political standard to avoid arriving at the conclusion that he should, you know, be impeached and removed. But I am worried that impeachment is going to turn into a regular part of the partisan toolkit. Will the Joe Biden impeachment be fun? It might be. I'm not really sure. I hope we don't get to that. And I sort of hope that we don't have a long series of impeachments where it's just something the parties do to one another. But I think it is reasonable to worry about that today, given the way things are turning out.
So can I say something which is both naive but controversial? Yeah, I'm sure you would hate that. Okay. So let's think about the Bill Clinton precedent. And I voted for Bill Clinton. I supported Bill Clinton. At the time, I did not support his impeachment and removal from office. I'm now rethinking that, and it kind of surprises me. So people say it was just personal behavior, it was just sexual behavior, and I agree that it's not the moral equivalent of what we're talking about now. But let's think about this from a 2020 perspective. Here's a guy who abused a power imbalance between the President of the United States and a young intern, right? And perhaps the kind of conduct that has come out in the last 20 or 30 years since the Clinton, since Clinton was not removed from office would not have been deemed so acceptable. But more important, Clinton did demonstrably lie to a grand jury in an official proceeding. And perhaps if we didn't sanction the President of the United States lying in a legal proceeding, it would not be so acceptable now for to have a President of the United States who feels free to lie. So whether or not you are a Clinton fan, I think we ought to reflect about what the precedent was of the result in the Clinton impeachment and whether we like it today.
Okay. Anything, Jim?
I'm going to take the unpopular stance that I am less bothered by partisan impeachments than Jeremy. I like when the legislative branch throws its weight around, even if it's just one chamber and one party, because the presidency sure throws its weight around a lot. And if I can could see that, well, it's not ideal, because impeachment should be something that ideally is about the full branch kind of striking back. If it's something where the legislative branch hits back against presidents and keeps them on their toes a little bit more than they presently are, maybe that's not the worst thing, even if it's also probably not the best thing.
But how does that play to the point that Bob was just making about that precedent? You know, maybe if something that happened last time be different this time, when really it just comes down to a partisan vote after all then?
I don't think that Clinton's behavior was sanctioned. Like, I would take exception to that. He was impeached for lying to a grand jury. He was not removed from office, and that's fine. And like, maybe you want also the removal. But he's still impeached. It's still a sanction it's the second most extreme sanction you can give to a president is a House impeachment. The most extreme is the Senate removal. But it's still more than a censure. It's still more than just a tisk-tisk or a House resolution, which is how Congress typically sanctions officials. It's an impeachment. And so I'd say, like, that's not the strongest sanction you should put on a president for poor behavior, but it's, or could, but I think it's not allowing it to go unmentioned. And I think we'd be in a worse position in terms of presidents getting away with that kind of behavior if it just went unaddressed, whether it was in a partisan or a bipartisan way.
Okay. Interesting points. Another question. All right, we have one in the back. Maybe our youngest question of all time. I don't know. Maybe that's a long time. overstating.
How do you think the impeachment outcome will impact the climate of the upcoming presidential election?
That's a really good question. And I'm curious to see if we have disagreement here. I don't think it'll have a very big impact, in part because people already have extremely strong opinions about President Trump on both sides. There's not a lot of people who look at the president and say, I'm not sure. Maybe I like him, maybe I don't. Like, there's some, but it's fewer than usual. This episode largely reinforces people's existing opinions. If you didn't like the president, you don't like him now. And if you did like him, it's just you probably shaking his head. If you did like him, like, it probably didn't change that. So to some degree, it just continues to reinforce the, like, what we've seen around President Trump's presidency since the first day, which is really sharply divided opinions about him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jeremy.
I could not lay out a case that would be different than anything Jim just said about the general election. I don't think it is likely to affect the general election for very similar reasons to what Jim said. I do wonder if it's going to affect the primary, because we haven't talked about this much, but there are a bunch of senators that are running for president. Their feet will now be metaphorically nailed to the floor in the Senate. They will not be allowed to talk about it. I can't wait to see if they can hold up under that restriction. And this means they're not going to be campaigning in Iowa. Does this help someone like Joe Biden or Pete Buttigieg, who will not be operating under these restrictions? So I actually think it could impact the upcoming primary race. And I think it could also, maybe more broadly, if Democrats somehow, and I don't know how this would happen, develop some kind of difference of opinion intra-party over impeachment, that could impact things. But by the time we get around to the general election, my opinion is exactly the same as Jim's.
So I know I should defer to the political sciences, scientists on the political science, but you guys weighed in on the law, right? So fair is fair. So I agree that a large percentage of the American public is locked into one, to being pro-Trump or anti-Trump. But the last election was decided by roughly 70,000 votes in a few key districts, and there are undecided people in the middle. And I think a lot of those people are looking very carefully, and it could, I think, affect what those key people in the middle think. There's the other issue of how it affects the elections for the US Senate next time, because the American public is looking very carefully about how the Senate acts here. And I'm not making a prediction about whether it means the Democrats might take over the Senate or not. But I do think that voters are going to look at what their senators, how their senators, not just the presidential candidates, vote on these key procedural and other issues, and it could have an impact.
Not a full rebuttal, but a mini rebuttal to that. No one ever went broke underestimating the American public's lack of interest in politics, okay? They are more interested in Harry and Meghan, Sussex Royal, whatever Harry Styles' latest album is. They're more interested in other things. I spoke to two good friends, both intelligent people, both make a lot of money. They're very smart. Neither one of them was aware that impeachment is starting today. And so while I agree that it's the part of his comment that I think makes a lot of sense, it is actually a really small margin to win next time. So maybe it would have an effect. I can't rule that out. But the public cares less about these things than we think they do, or we might want them mm-hmm. to care. They just do.
And historically, of course, impeachment did not launch either party substantially forward. Interesting point. Okay, other questions? Yeah.
Well, if I could ask a technical question, if I may. The panelist on the right, our right, you obliquely.
Yeah, you. Okay, Jer.
Is this another psychobabble question?
I think it was you, Jeremy.
You obliquely referred to John Rawls, and you said that perhaps, I don't think that was Bob, that was you.
I did originally.
Right. You said that, or maybe I missed that because I was a bit late coming in, yeah, so. You did mention that perhaps it's not the Rawlsian idea of justice that we should be talking about now, talking about justice in this process, but you know, In a sense, you are right. In a sense, you are not. Rawls was obviously talking about distributive justice, okay? But the standards of distributive justice, that idea of procedural fairness, you know, that also comes to criminal justice as well, and comes in politics as well, procedural fairness. So in that sense, I think justice, even in the Rawlsian sense, in a very foundational sense, is very, very latent in the whole procedure. The question is how politics and justice emerge together, and Rawls had a lot to say on that too. But one point he was quite clear, which is that in politics, perceptions matter. In democracy, especially in a liberal democracy, perceptions matter. And so the perception of procedural fairness, you know, regardless of the actual substance, is something that you cannot ignore. And that's where this thing is all about. You know, it's more like a comment, perhaps. You know,
I don't have a strong rejoinder because I certainly, I mean, I would be happy if we were all Rawlsians about impeachment. That would be great. I'm not entirely convinced that that could happen under the Constitution, or that human beings are built in a way to produce that kind of reaction to this. That's why I think I'm not entirely sure it's about justice. Maybe it would be better if it was, but I just suppose I'm not entirely convinced that it is about justice.
Interesting. Okay.
It is, although I hate to be such a constitutional literalist, but there is nothing in the Constitution that says the Senate has to write fair rules. It just says they get to write the rules.
And there's nothing in any congressional rules about them being fair. They're just ways of making decisions. And sometimes they're fair and sometimes they're not, but it doesn't matter.
You know, I agree with that, and I understand and accept the point that the political branches can do whatever they have the votes to do. But perception is also important. And whether or not a majority of the American public is paying attention, a substantial percentage of the American public is paying attention. If we had a system of rules in trials in which the judge could change the rules of the game based on who the defendant was, our perception of fairness in the system would be shattered. So imagine what would happen if a member of our community was accused of defrauding his neighbors. You know, fraudulent investment scheme, took their money, squirreled it away in the Cayman Islands, and they were brought before a court, and it turned out that the judge was their friend. And the judge said, I have consulted with defense counsel, and we have agreed that the rules of this trial should be different from any other federal trial. And I don't think the prosecutor should be able to introduce documents or other evidence. I'm just going to decide this based on, you know, what my impressions are. The American public would think that is not a fair process. Why should we not expect the same in terms of fair process? I totally agree that there is a political judgment about whether the accused in impeachment committed an offense which rises to the level of affecting our politic enough to be removed from office. That's the legitimate political judgment. Process, I think, is something that ought to be irrespective of who the accused is. That's my major point.
Okay, so I'm going to ask the last question because we only have a couple minutes left. You know, one may be leaving this room a little bit less positive than when they came in. And since you all are in the business of...
That's my fault.
Since you all are in the business of, you know, of giving us reason and purpose, give us a positive thing that we can maybe take from what we're seeing that's going to make our students say, I'm going to stay engaged in this process no matter what. This is a tall order right there.
This is your separation of powers, checks and balances system of government in action. You should be happy about this. This means that our constitutional system is functioning the way it was designed. More than 200, almost 250, I can't do math, however many years later, 240 plus years later. That's a good thing. It may be messy, you may not want the outcome that you're gonna get, but this is that system working as it was intended to ensure that no one group or person or faction or anything else has too much power. And so that is your positive takeaway. When things like this, when you see a conflict like this, that, and you immediately think, oh, this is conflict, this is bad, flip that switch and say, no, this is conflict, this is good. This is what our system is set up to do, and it's doing it.
try to remember that. Okay, Jeremy, please.
Institutions are not set in stone. If you are unhappy with how this impeachment turns out, if you don't like what happens, get involved. Change the rules. There's a broad movement afoot at the moment to change one really massive thing here, which is the U.S. Senate. There are people who think we shouldn't have a Senate because it's an inherently unfair institution. Go out there and try to figure out a way to change the rules. One lesson that people should always learn, in addition to what Jim said, is that institutions matter. And this impeachment trial is going more or less the way that the institutions were set up to go. So if you don't like it, change the institutions in some small way. Our institutions are very different than they were a couple of centuries ago. It can be done.
That's good. Bob, last word.
So let me augment what Jim said, because I agree with it, by going back to what Ben Franklin said. In many countries in the world, what's the alternative, you know, to the process that we have? It's coup d'etat, it's assassination. This is the peaceful, rational alternative when we think we've got leaders who have done something wrong. And the process, whether you like the result or not, is a good one.
This is good stuff today. So glad to have it. This was a fascinating discussion. Let's give a hand for these panelists. All right.
If you'd like to listen to another Hinckley Forum, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.